Morning, members. We're going to get started, and we're going to start with House File 1383, Representative Newton. Members, we don't have minutes today, so we won't be approving minutes. Yeah, I know it's a great disappointment, but hopefully we'll get those for our next hearing. Do you have three bills? Four. Members, we have four bills on the docket. It is not my intent to bring us back this evening. But nonetheless, if we can get through these, it would be wonderful. We will have a hearing on Thursday, and we'll hopefully wrap up our bill hearings at that time. Representative Newton, I will move House File. Welcome to the committee. I will move House File 1383 be recommended to pass and referred to
Government
Committee on Government Operations. Representative Newton, your bill is before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have two amendments to the bill.
Very well.
The A1 amendment, which deletes the repealers, and the A2 amendment that adds special education teachers to the requirement for the committee to have special education teachers as a part of the district's participation.
And Representative Newton, it would be your desire that we move those amendments? Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Representative Newton, I will move the A1 amendment. Is there a discussion on that motion? If not, all approve. Approving, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. And Representative Newton, you'd like me to move the A2 amendment? Is that right?
Yes.
Very well. Chair will move the A2 amendment. Discussion. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Newton, your bill is before us as you would wish it to be.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill has the department and the governor's office is very interested in establishing a special education task force that's made up of 10 members, including parents of children with disabilities. And it comes out of the OLA report, even though I think the bill was prepared before we finally received the OLA report, to address the issues of special education and the concerns that were expressed in the Office of Legislative Auditor's report. I have the department here who would like to testify, as well as Sue Abderholden, I believe, would like to testify, and Elaine Keith as well, as to the bill.
Very well. Is there someone from the department that would care to come down and testify? Good morning, Mr. McHenry.
Mr. Chair, members, Kevin McHenry, Department of Education. First off, we do want to thank Representative Newton for bringing this bill forward. Last Thursday, there was quite a discussion on trying to find ways. There was a kind of an amendment to get rid of all paperwork that went beyond federal regulations, and we talked about the idea of trying to move forward with more of a an approach that was not as broad. We're working with some of the advocates on this as we go forward, specifically with NAMI and with PACER, to make sure that as we move forward, we're doing this in a responsible manner. I think with the amendment, what happened is the repealers were taken out, and there were some objections that were brought forward in regards to sub-goals for IEPs. In discussing this with NAMI and PACER, I think we want to make sure that as we move forward in a responsible manner, and we'll continue to do so. I think the plan and what we've discussed with them is to bring forward some recommendations for potential either repeals or to find other ways to arrive at some efficiencies to lower paperwork or lower mandates without lowering the quality of services that is needed. So with that, I think we just wanted to be on record that we're hoping to continue the deliberation and to try to find some ways that we can reduce some of this paperwork. So with that, I'll stand for questions.
Are there any questions for the department? Representative Cresha.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. And just a question about reducing the paperwork, and I noticed you used the word paperwork. What about reducing workload?
Mr. McHenry.
Mr. Chair, members, and that's a great question. I think that we kind of see those as hand in hand, that as part of this task force, it is looking at caseloads, so that is the workload. So obviously, I think the end goal is whether it's paperwork, whether it's a mandate, whether it's workload, we're trying to find ways that can be efficient to make sure that teachers spend more time in the classroom with their students and can be as efficient as possible to make sure that the work outside of the classroom isn't taking away from what's going inside of the classroom.
Representative Cresha.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. And I'll just make the point really clear because I hear it all the time. You could reduce paperwork by requiring it to go to a digital form, but there's a huge difference between lowering the stack and lowering the amount of hours that somebody puts in. So I realize you may not have an answer, but it's just one of the things that I hear all the time in my districts.
And Mr. Chair, members, that is one of the things that we are pursuing is in the overall governor's budget where it streamlines what's included in the IEP. So districts can know that when they're filling out their forms or when the teachers are filling out their forms, that they're right to the standards of what needs to apply. Obviously, there are sometimes that things can that forms can go beyond what is required, and that can take some additional time. And it is one of those things I think we, you know, as districts or department, we have to be careful to make sure that we're providing the proper tools necessary.
Mr. Chair, if I could add, in District 11, we looked at this several years ago. And special education is kind of a burnout profession. We have a hard time keeping teachers for a long time. And some of the complaints have been that not so much that it's difficult working with children, special needs children, it's all the amount of time that they're pulled away from children in order to do not only the paperwork, but the meetings after meetings. And so hopefully we're going to be able to work with the advocates and find some ways to relieve this for the teachers.
Representative Nornes has a question.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, thank you. I guess one simple question. Is there an appropriation? Is there any reimbursement for the task force members?
Representative Newton? Mr. McHenry.
Mr. Chair, members, there's a in statute, there's guidance as far as how task forces are put together. We don't, we've done several task forces at the department. We don't have a specific cost as a reimbursement. However, there's mileage. And there's also there's mileage included for members that have to travel far distances. Task forces will go through the open appointments process. So I think the idea is to make sure that there's representation throughout the state in a variety of areas. But we don't actually, there's not a per diem in place for members that are on task forces.
Mr. Chair, I was just concerned about mileage. Assuming they're coming from outstate Minnesota, that can get a little expensive.
And Representative Newton, I presume your bill will be traveling to Ed Finance if it makes it through GovOps, where that could be. Representative Nornes's yes. Question will be fully vetted. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Very well. Representative Erickson, Sandra.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll pass because my question was where was it going and was it coming to finance? And you answered that. Thank you.
So it's a Vulcan mind melt we have here. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Newton. I received I received a communication from someone with the Minnesota Brain Injury Alliance, and I just want to read a few lines that perhaps you could address one of their concerns. It says, we oppose the repeal of short-term objectives and progress reporting that is hidden in the bill and strongly encourage that this provision be taken out of the bill. The proposed repeal of two subparts of Minnesota R 3525.2810 would remove the provisions concerning short-term objectives and progress reporting. Is there something about taking reporting out of the bill?
Representative Newton, I believe we struck that provision out in your amendments.
In the amendment, it has been taken out.
Okay. Thank you. That's just what I wanted to be clear on.
Very well. It's good to be clear, members. Representative Falls.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about Section 1, Subdivision 2, where it says that a special education caseload task force shall develop recommendations for the maximum number of students with disabilities that may be assigned to a teacher, both with and without paraprofessional support in the classroom. Now, isn't there a huge variation between how much time different students take from a teacher? So how can we pass or make recommendations when there's such a variation between one student and another?
Sure. Mr. McHenry.
Mr. Chair, members, I think that's the idea of trying to delve a little bit deeper into the topic. Obviously, I don't think we want to have just a blanket statement of here's what you know, the caseload should be. We want to make sure that there's a chance for the task force to take a broader look at maybe what different types of students teachers are serving, and maybe so we can have a deeper look. Some students may take more time than others, and maybe through this task force they can delineate what that might be. It's similar, this is something we did make some changes in our in the special ed formula in the governor's budget, where it did delineate between different disabilities of how funds would flow. And I'm not saying that's how this task force would work, but we could look at maybe the same mechanism of looking at different types of disabilities and what type of, how that could apply to different caseloads.
Mr. Chair, can I just add an example of that? Was at Blaine High School, we had a student who tended to be pretty violent, and his parents insisted on the IEP that he stay mainstreamed in high school. He not only had a special ed teacher, he had two paraprofessionals with him all day. He had three people with him all day long, as opposed to a child that might have a mild form of ADD that requires much less attention and can probably be mainstreamed virtually all the day.
Representative Falls.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that's exactly my point. And so I how can somebody, seven people or however many are on the task force in St. Paul, 10 people, make those decisions for the school when there is such a wide range, I guess is my question. So, but I think we're heading in the right direction, I guess.
I think in the right direction is a good thing to do. Representative Sawatsky. I can come back to you. Representative Roger Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple questions now. Assigned to a teacher, you're talking a classroom teacher? Is that what we're referring to, or a special ed teacher?
Mr. McHenry.
Mr. Chair, members, it is assigned to a teacher or a paraprofessional, so it's dealing with the teacher or the paraprofessional that's actually working with the students.
So I'm reading this, maximum number of students with disabilities may be assigned to a teacher, both with or without paraprofessional support in the classroom. Are we talking special ed teacher there or classroom teacher?
Mr. McHenry.
Mr. Chair, members, it's specifically, it's for all teachers. Obviously, there are some students with disabilities that are served. They're not always in the one specific classroom. They're served in all classrooms. So if it was just specified to just special education teachers, it wouldn't be looking at the caseloads that for students with disabilities that are participating in classrooms with teachers that aren't special education teachers.
So it's meant to be inclusive of, mm-hmm. of both, in essence. It's a good clarifying question, Representative Ertz.
But there would then be differences in the amount of caseload that a special ed teacher could have at one particular time, and what a classroom teacher, there's going to be two different quotas or guidelines or whatever. My question then would be, in a small rural town and let's say you have 25 students in a grade that just happens to have two or three quite special ed students that would maybe go over the ratio that you have, are you suggesting then that they would be forced to split that into two teachers then, to meet that caseload?
Mr. McHenry.
Mr. Chair, members, this would be obviously the work of the task force would be to dive into all of the details here and bring forward recommendations. They wouldn't be implemented without going through the legislature. So I think the idea is bringing the professionals together to make the recommendations so that this committee and others in the legislature can provide, have some more information to make some decisions moving forward. A decision like that, I don't think would be able to be instituted without having some follow-up with legislation in the following session.
Well, Representative Slotsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for the record, and just to have a little bit of background on Representative Erdahl's discussion and the letter that we did get from a parent who is concerned about the short-term objectives and cutting down on paperwork, and I, as a special ed teacher, a few years ago we had heard that the objectives might be going, or that it's not necessary, or the feds or somebody isn't requiring that, but our district and state is continuing to have those, and kept thinking there was a ray of hope that maybe there is some change for some changes in the IEP and expectations, or the due process, I should say, not the IEP, but due process, because it is quite lengthy. But to that, and I just want to have on record so that we can all be thinking about this, what short-term objectives are. Every year, every grading period, we need to write to the progress of the goals. We don't write to the progress of the objectives. We write to the project of the goals, progress of the goal. And so, for instance, if a student is in front of me with a reading fluency disability, and the goal is to improve their reading rate to 100 words per minute, given a third grade reading, grade level or whatever reading material, then underneath we have to create objectives that shorten that. So by 3 months, and we would like them to, the goal is to get 50 words per minute, and then 75 words per minute, and then finally the goal is 100 words per minute. But our task is at every grading period, which is if you grade quarterly or if you grade by the trimester, but then also when you have parent-teacher conferences, that's, again, a formal time that we have to. So we are making progress to the goals maybe 8 times a year. And so those objectives are kind of just like little stepping stones. We never look at those, really, after we write them, because the goal is really the goal. And so we're always writing to the goal. So I just want, and I know that that's going to step on some toes, and I know that that's uncomfortable for some groups, and maybe teachers as well, or paraprofessionals or parents or administrators, but just as a person who's done this for 28 years, we're looking at the goal always. That's our end result, is because that's the task. That's what we have to reach. And in 12-month period, if we can't reach that goal, then we know halfway through the contract whether or not it's attainable or not, because we always have to write a sentence on the bottom as well. The goal is attainable at this time. We think that we can carry on. If we don't think it is, then we have to come back to the table and redo the goal. We don't redo the objectives. We redo the goal. So I am very excited to have this opportunity to work with the people, the agencies, that to look at the due process.
Very well. Representative Iuso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. in view of the questions we've had about the, it's really subdivision 2 and subdivision 3 about the maximum number, I think I'm wondering if the language on line 1.14 isn't unintentionally kind of restrictive, because it does say recommendations for the maximum number of students that may be assigned to a teacher. And if you contrast that with what it says on 1.18, where it talks about appropriate case loads for teachers. So the second one suggests that there might be different case loads assigned for different situations. But the line 1.14 says there will be the maximum number. And I think that regardless of what the intentions are that Mr. McHenry has explained to us, that the language says they're going to come up with the maximum number, and I wonder if that shouldn't maybe be tweaked somehow.
Mr. McHenry? Mr. Newton?
Mr. Chair, I don't think at this point it needs to be tweaked. I think what we're trying to do is get this task force up and running to be representative of all areas of the state, all degrees of special needs, and to work through this. This, as you know, Mr. Chair, has been an ongoing process. We started this 3 years ago, and it was there was a lot of discussion that went on. We made some changes. Some of us think there are more changes to be made. Others think that we haven't done enough in terms of rules and so forth. So, Representative Yarusso, I believe that's really what the task force is trying to do. And it's not going to be an easy task because, as Representative Erickson points out, you've got rural districts with very limited number of students. You've got big districts like mine with 3,000 students in a school. It's difficult for them to do it, but that's the objective of the task force.
Representative Yarusso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand what Representative Newton, what you're saying. I just worry that when the task force comes back in 2014, I don't know who's going to be sitting in these chairs, and what they've been assigned to do is to come up with the maximum number. And so it's a question of interpreting something that looks more definite than you intend in a statute.
Mr. Chair.
No response. Okay, Ms. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry. I'm not on my game today. Representative Russo, you are done. Is that correct? You're done.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I apologize. Representative Erickson.
And Mr. Chair, to Representative Yarusso's point, she's right on, because if the language remains as it is, Representative Newton, the charge to the task force will be this. And so the point that Representative Yarusso has made is one that you probably need to mull over and determine whether the charge to the task force will be that specific. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson, we'll work with the department on this and look at this before it goes to GovOps.
Okay.
Thanks.
Representative Blyer.
Thank you, Chair. And Representative Newton, I support your effort in trying to establish some kind of task force that would address some of these issues. My caution, I guess, would be that this is a tremendously complex area, and I'm always wary of making decisions about something where there is such variation, as some members have mentioned, in not only districts but schools and students and teachers. I recall working in special ed myself, and I had a level 5 program and wanted to try to place students with teachers. There were some teachers that could manage several students in their classrooms that had the difficulties that my students had, and some students that I would be very wary to place a student there. And so there are decisions like that are very difficult. The other thing that crosses my mind, having worked in alternative schools where many times special education students are happier in those environments, they're more included in classrooms. And I think that comes from looking at because in alternative schools we were required to have continual learning plans, which were really individual plans for students, similar, not the same as, but similar to IEPs. And I'm somewhat heartened by some of the talk that Representative Beinert has included in her assessment reforms about looking at students individually. And I would hope that the task force, in addition to dealing with the discussion about tremendous variety and be cautioned not to be too prescriptive in what they assign to districts and classrooms to do, but be thinking about if we truly were looking at each student as they come to a school individually and evaluating their needs, there may be less need for this kind of superstructure that has come with special education. And it's become a kind of animal on itself, and it really sometimes I think can hinder, in part because a lot of the arguments that emerge from special education have to do with either medical model issues or with legal issues that are really complex and difficult to deal with, and they sometimes have to do with who's going to pay for this, or who's going to be responsible for, or who's right about what, you know, what kind of remedy is prescribed, and whether or not adequate progress is being made, and what is that progress? To say nothing of the fact that students learn differently, they progress differently, things that you may see at an earlier age may disappear as they get older. There are so many complex things here, so good luck.
Representative Newton, did you have other testifiers?
I believe Ms. Abderholder.
Ms. Abderholder, why don't you come forward? Thank you, Mr. McHenry.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Sue Abderholden with NAVI Minnesota. You know, first I just want to say that I've actually worked on special ed issues since 1981. I went to my first IEP meeting in 1977. I was 13 at the time. But anyway, I've been around a long time watching these issues. And the solution that we've always brought forward is, well, where do we exceed federal? That's the solution that we brought forward over and over again. I just want to remind people that we've actually looked at this three times, and that in 2009, we actually put forward changes, and we worked together in a very hot room to make that happen, and we actually went through a lot of the due process sections of the law, streamlined it to conform to federal, and really worked hard to do that. We changed transition services so that they began in ninth grade and not just at age 14. So I just want to say we really have done that. I do want to just kind of go back to the idea of the short-term objectives, and you know, it really kind of depends on the goal. Some goals are very easy where you can see that you're making progress. Others are kind of vague. I talked to a mom last night, and the goal for her son, who has early onset bipolar disorder, ADHD, anxiety, and Asperger's, but one of his goals is Joe will be more organized. Yeah. Well, how do you get there? What does that mean? And his short-term objective was that he will be filling out his planner 4 out of the 5 days in terms of his assignments and what he had to do. Well, that's an easy thing for the mom to grab onto as well, to say, okay, well, that's what I need to work on at home. I did pull out, just for the fun of it, the Federal Register for the IDEA regulations. And when they looked at the, particularly the short-term objectives, back in 99 for that particular one, they said that the purpose of both, the goals and the short-term objectives or benchmarks, is to enable a child's teachers, parents, and others involved in developing and implementing the child's IEP to gauge at intermediate times during the year how well the child is progressing toward achievement of the annual goal. Now, it's true that the Congress eliminated the short-term objectives, but still in the rule in 2004, they went back and said that, you know, that this was really important. They were originally intended to assist parents in monitoring their child's progress toward meeting the child's annual goals. And we believe a state could, if it chose to do so, determine the extent to which short-term objectives are in there. So it has continued to be a really important part of the process. I believe that, and I want to note that just in the discussion already this morning, trying to figure out what the solution is for a problem that's been around for at least 15 years, and you think we would have found an easy one by now, is really difficult. You know, is it caseloads? Is it something else that needs to be looked at? Just saying paperwork, I think, is a really difficult thing, because what rule exactly is making that happen? I'm glad that there's additional language in there, which we'll continue to work with the department and others on, to look again a little bigger and a little bit more creatively. For example, one of the requirements is that you have a parent advisory committee. Now, what's the goal of that committee? The goal of the committee is to have input into how the district is doing on special education, and they're required to meet once a year. Now, can we allow conference calls as a way to meet? Can we Skype? Can we allow surveys? Are there other ways to get the input from the parents than actually having a meeting? Now, that doesn't exceed federal. So if you just focus on where we exceed federal, you're not going to be creative about what you can do. And what we really want to do is to bring folks together who are on the ground doing this to say, so what efficiencies could we achieve? What could we do differently that makes sense in this day and age? So I'm glad that that language is in there. I don't think, in all the time I've been around, that we've come together to look just at that. We've only focused on where we exceed federal. And so I think it is time to bring people together. We have, really since 2009, we've created a great working relationship, with the School Board Association, with MACE, with teachers, with everybody. And I think we could put us in a room and come up with things that are creative that you have never thought of. So I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Abderhold?
Mr. Chair, while Ms. Keefe is coming down from PACER, Ms. Larson had suggested to me an oral amendment that I think will solve what both Representatives Urusso and Erickson had mentioned, and that's on line 114, instead of having the maximum number of students. We change that to the appropriate numbers of students, which is much more general in approach. And I would like to, if someone could offer that for me as an oral amendment, I would appreciate that.
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, I'll offer the that amendment to, on page 1, line 14, delete the word maximum and insert the word
maximum number,
delete the words maximum number and insert the word appropriate.
Numbers.
Well, Ms. Larson, can you, for the record, state the language Representative Dabney wishes to move here.
Mr. Chairman, members, on House File 1383, on page 1, line 14, delete maximum number and insert appropriate numbers.
Very well. Discussion, members? All in favor of that oral amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Ms. Keefe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And a representative just said to me, I thought this would go quicker, so I promised him I'd be very brief. I think my main task here is to go on record so that the department is assured that the folks that I represent are very willing to work with them over the remaining weeks of the session, if we can get something done quickly, and certainly over the interim to come back with some good recommendations for you. For the record, I'm Elaine Keefe. I represent the Coalition for Children with Disabilities. PACER is the largest organization in that coalition, but to be fair, in addition to PACER, I also, other members of the coalition are the Epilepsy Foundation, the International Dyslexia Association, the Brain Injury Association, the Autism Society, the Minnesota Organization on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome, and the Prader-Willi Syndrome Association. And we appreciate the removal of the repealers from the bill. I do want to say we are absolutely committed to working with all parties to produce good outcomes for kids and make the system as streamlined as possible. And that includes reducing paperwork, reducing the workload for teachers, however we can do that and still produce good outcomes for kids. So I thank you very much, and we will get to work.
Thank you, Ms. Keefe, and Ms. Abderholden as well. Thank you. You heard the legislative auditor's report earlier this session. We are, I think I speak for everyone here, where when I say that we are anxiously awaiting good forward movement on this in a short period of time.
Mr. Chair, if I might add, I have my copy right here all marked up, so and I do have a few ideas that were gleaned from it. So
very well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify in the bill? Mr. Heller, you've asked to testify. If you can, and if anyone else wishes to testify, please come forward. I'd like to move us relatively quickly here. We still have several bills before us, including another one of yours, Representative. Two. Well, we might hold those hostage. Mr. Heller.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Marinari, and sorry about pronunciation. I'll get it down one of these days. And policy board members, thank you, Mr. Newton. Nice to meet you again.
Good to see you, Ray.
I unofficially represent the print disabled twice exceptional learners in Minnesota. As you all know, I've mentioned before that you'll find it in the governor's bill 1151 and page 11 and 12. That's exceptional language. Those are students that are labeled with one of the 13 and 14 disabilities, as well as they're gifted, meaning they process information in a unique way, which is the how of learning. Regarding this bill, 1383, and getting a task force together, I'm all for task force, especially on universal design for learning and the print disabled or even twice exceptional learners. The caseload is interesting. I didn't hear anything, the testimony today about positive intervention plans, which is uniquely required with special education for special design instruction. Minnesota is using, as you all know, early intervention targeted called response intervention. They're requiring that, frankly, if there's a behavior issue, you just don't focus on that. You also work on the academic. It's the responsibility of IEP team. If there's an issue with having too many caseload people on a situation, for instance, if a student has 10 days, a manifestation termination meeting is needed, recalled or considered, and then a functional behavior assessment usually follows that to help get the behavior under control. Because, frankly, I don't think you need two paraprofessionals in special education on a student once you know basically how they learn and how they function. One thing I find disturbing with the Blaine High School specifically is there, for instance, they're reading out loud.
Mr.
In all the essential classes.
I hate to interrupt, but we don't have a whole lot of time to get into a particular school actions. I think this bill is successful. Certainly would be my hope that you would track this task force and that your interests would be represented. We're here to basically broadly speak about moving forward a group that can review caseloads here, and so there may be other opportunities to talk about very specific issues.
So
if you can wrap up, that would be wonderful.
As far as putting ceiling and limits in special education, it's to meet the unique needs of an individual learner. If it requires more at a short time period, likely in this situation, unless Mr. Newton knows specifics of it, I would think that they would address that with a positive intervention plan. So the appropriate probably would be the loosest word, and recommendation would also be a loose word because it wouldn't be a requirement. And to put requirements in special education, especially when it relates to special design instruction, including any positive intervention plans, and perhaps the principals being more engaged in a meaningful way regarding bullying in the classrooms as a gifted leader, that would be a helpful element to this. So at this point, I would say yes to the bill that I would ask that. What I found out with caseloads is the staff, for instance, are not trained with this DVD called Aiming for Success, because what I found out is that the Minsky went bankrupt
Mr. Heller, I'm going to ask you to wrap up right now. I appreciate the advice and your comment, the amendment was appropriate. I think your point is well taken, and I would hope that you'll participate in some way with the task force if this bill is successful. I want to thank you for your testimony. Representative Newton.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. Representative, I will renew my motion that House File 1383, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Government Operations.
Thank you.
All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Good luck, Representative Newton. It's very important work.
Thank you, Representative Newton.
You have House File 356. The chair will move House File 356 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Education and Finance.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And we also have amendments on House File 356. I believe, and I'm looking to Ms. Abderholden for guidance here, is it just the second amendment?
I thought you were going
about the Second Amendment.
Yeah.
That's in Paymar's committee.
The A2. Mr. Chair, quick question.
Representative Anderson.
Coming from the private sector, I'm not accustomed to all these task forces, so I have to ask this question. I'm not kept score. Maybe you or our freshly clean-shaven administrator could help me with. How many task forces have we created so far just this session?
Representative Anderson, we can certainly quantify that. That's not the issue before us, though. Do you have a task force in this bill, Representative?
There's no task force in this. Just
oh,
many.
Good.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Erdahl.
In one of my conversations in the back of the room here, I actually found out the answer to that today.
Wonderful.
12.
Trying to make government work. Representative Newton, do you have an amendment that you wish the chair to move?
Yes. It's a K2 amendment. Yeah, it's the A2 amendment, Mr. Chair.
The chair will move adoption of the A2 amendment. Representative Newman, would you care to speak to the amendment quickly?
Yeah. The amendment changes the amount from $30 to $40, to $45, excuse me, on line 10, and on line 11, it goes from $10 to $15.
Very well. So this will shape it up in the proposal you wish to have legislature entertain. All in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 356 increases the safe schools levy from $30 to $45 for school districts and from $10 to $15 for intermediate school districts. It extends the allowable uses to allow school districts to pay the cost for co-locating and collaborating with mental health professionals. So it adds in as part of the safe schools provision mental health, and it includes a blank appropriation to use state funds for positive behavior intervention and supports. And I have with me again Ms. Sue Abderholden from NAMI, who would like to address the committee.
Ms. Abderholden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Sue Abderholden with NAMI, Minnesota. You've all heard already about schooling to mental health services and how important they are, but they work very closely with the school support personnel. So, with the school social workers, school psychologists, school nurses, and school counselors. And so we're really kind of putting the two together. We need to make sure that we have the school support personnel there to do kind of the earlier intervention and supports. And then we need to make sure that we have the clinical staff on the other side for kids who need much more. One aspect of this bill is that we do allow safe school levy funds to be used to pay for collaboration with the mental health professional in those districts that don't have a schooling to mental health grant. We do have districts doing that now. Actually, I think in Representative Barrett's district, they're doing that. They've already collaborated with the local provider, even though they didn't get a grant. And we just want to make sure that you can do that collaboration. One reason to make sure that the clinical person is not an employee is that FERPA, the Privacy Records for Education, trump HIPAA, the healthcare records, and so we do want to keep those separate. And then lastly, there's funding for PBIS, which is an evidence-based program that addresses social behavioral issues so that school is a safe place for all children. It is evidence-based, and it has reduced suspensions and referrals to principals and things like that. So this is kind of part of the continuum that we're trying to create for children. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. I know there's another testifier as well.
Are there any questions for Ms. Abderholt? Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and not particularly a question other than to say that, I tend to be supportive of this because of the flexibility in the safe school levy, and not just, for mental health issues like this, but there are, I think, other bills or amendments floating around that deal with more flexibility for school facilities under safe school, and I'm hopeful that in education finance or wherever it is, if members are there, that they will be supportive of these initiatives as well.
Thank you. Are there other testifiers? Meanwhile, Representative Brainerd has a question.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Newton, my question for you is about a bill we heard earlier in education finance in which you did away with the Safe Schools Levy. So I'm going to ask you to comment on the fact that you're carrying these two pieces of legislation and how you'd like us to reconcile that.
Representative Newton, that's a very good question.
Thank you. That's a wonderful question. Actually, I don't think we did away with the Safe Schools Levy. We're looking at a bill that Representative Hertaus brought to the K-12 Finance Committee that really does what Representative Erdahl was talking about. It expands it so that it also includes facilities itself and not just, you know, getting kids from their home to school, but also improving the facilities at the school so the schools are safer for children. And I think we've got several things that we're probably going to be rolling into this Safe Schools Levy as we move forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'll go back and look at the language of your other bill, too, but my understanding was the Safe School Levy was being rolled into the facilities categorical. So you might want to look at that language, too, because I'm not sure these are compatible.
Representative Newton, the chair probably should have caught and acted on this weeks ago, but it is a little unusual, you know, to have essentially policy language moving in two trajectories, one through the Education Finance Committee, which only a few of us sit on that committee, and then other language here. So we're going to really, assuming this is successful, we're going to really count on you to be able to, in fact, do some very careful listening to what members of this committee are concerned with and make sure that that's represented in decisions in our finance.
So Mr. Chair, and I know Representative Brainerd, I think, has the answer now, but my bill actually was the health and safety bill. And the bill that Representative Hertaus brought forward the same day was the Safe Schools bill. And we think that we can roll some things in health and safety from the Safe Schools Levy as well.
Thank you. That helps me out as well. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Jeff Ronneberg, and I'm the superintendent of the Spring Lake Park Schools District. For those of you who may not be aware, we serve families in the communities of Blaine, Fridley, and Spring Lake Park in the North Metro. We're a growing district. Enrollment has increased by over 20% in the past 10 years, and we expect to increase by another 20% in the next 8 years, growing from 5,300 students today to more than 6,100 students in the future. While growing in total enrollment, we are also seeing a more diverse student body with more varied and unique needs than we've ever seen before. About 40% of our families qualify for free and reduced lunch. We see more and more students and their families living in crisis, and schools are being asked to provide wraparound services more than ever before. And that's why I'm here today to talk to you about the Safe Schools Levy and the proposed legislation. For many districts, the current Safe Schools Levy is used to pay for school liaison officers in the schools, and this base level of safety is important and it's needed. However, our teachers are encountering children with early signs of mental illness and those with more advanced levels in their classrooms on a more regular basis than ever before. We also experience families in crisis more than ever before, and parents struggling with poverty, substance abuse, or mental illness impact the learning of our students. Not so long ago in the Spring Lake Park schools, as well as other districts in the North Metro, we had a partnership with Anoka County in which we had four county social workers in the district. They would partner with us to provide wraparound services for families and students. When we saw a need that was outside our staff's areas of expertise or their reach, we worked with the social worker to access services for our students and sometimes their parents. As a principal at the time, I saw the direct and indirect benefits that the services provided for our students and their families. The students who received direct services benefited, as well as the many other students who attended classes with these students. Now, we no longer have this partnership, and as a result, those supports for students and their families are gone. Yet, as an example, Woodcrest Elementary School, which is a school of 400 K-3 students in the southern part of our district in Fridley, with 65% poverty, 55% non-white students, and 20% of the students speaking a first language other than English, we have identified 23 students, none of whom are identified as special education, who are either personally in crisis or have parents who have mental health issues who are impacting their learning. We struggle to provide these kids with necessary supports and the learning of these students and others is impacted. The stories of what these kids are struggling to overcome is amazing. It is equally amazing to see the lengths to which our staff goes, doing all in their power to meet the needs of these kids and to support the families. However, our staff lacks the expertise and the community networks to provide or easily access the supports. It is sad to see kids struggle with their learning when their parents are struggling, and we have few avenues by which we can access supports. Our school psychologists and school social workers are not clinical therapists, nor should the school be paying for medical needs such as clinical therapies. Some of our schools in Minnesota have had success with the model in which clinical therapists come into the school who are then able to, with parent permission, assist in treating those clinical needs. The challenge for schools in this model is that there are some critical activities, such as planning and reviewing with the staff, that are not reimbursed through medical insurance. This increase in the Safe Schools Levy will improve the opportunities for bringing these types of services or social work services to schools by being a revenue source to pay for these unreimbursed expenses. These investments in the mental health of students, especially with their mental health challenges, especially when these challenges are at an early onset, can help to prevent these challenges from becoming a lifelong debilitating illness. The mental health of our students is a real need. Many are living with or in conditions where they and or their family members need support if they are to be successful. Expanding the services provided through the Safe Schools Levy, allowing each school district to be flexible in their use of these funds to meet the unique needs of their students, can make a real difference for the learning of young people throughout the state. Thanks.
Thank you, Superintendent. I'm just curious, and it's a very broad question, but is it your sense that the growing need, if you will, is resulting from a growing incidence of issues for students, or are we just simply getting better at recognizing perhaps what may have been there for quite a while in our past, and we're being more responsible, but yet perhaps under-resourced in being able to do that?
Yeah. Well, first off, I wouldn't pretend to be that expert in that area to be able to say what that is, but our experience is that we have more students, some of it being that they're identified, but we also just have more families in need than we've ever had before. Mm-hmm. But I'm not going to pretend to be the expert in that area, but I just know that we have a lot of families in crisis. The biggest thing for us as a school district is we don't have the partnerships, those to be able to access the supports for those kids and their families like we did before.
And so the argument is that, you know, it's through these partnerships where we can be most efficient and effective and quickly intervening and assisting.
Exactly.
Very well. Thank you.
Thanks.
We have another testifier.
Good morning. Good morning. My name is Sandy Lewandowski. I'm the superintendent of Intermediate School District 287. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm pleased to represent all three intermediate school districts in Minnesota. And as intermediates, we provide extensive program for some of Minnesota's highest need students with complex special education needs. We also provide Area Learning Center programs for students who often have higher educational and mental health needs than students in local Area Learning Center programs. In my district alone, we serve over 600 full-time students in what we term our Setting for Special Education programs, and almost 400 Area Learning Center students and these students often come to us with chemical dependency issues. They are pregnant and parenting teens, students who've been adjudicated for truancy, as well as for more serious criminal offenses. It's safe to say from my experiences that mental health needs are increasing, and it is increasingly becoming a fundamental component of our educational program. Few community members can understand the extent and severity of the mental health needs of students who walk through our doors every day in the public school system. Without without mental health services, educational progress toward a high school diploma is extremely compromised. More importantly, without these critical services, student and staff safety may also be compromised. Last year in my district, we had over 300 staff injuries, with the vast majority of those injuries being a result of student behavior that had escalated and resulted in some kind of altercation with a staff person. I would like to share a recent example of why we think mental health services are such a critical component and that we would endorse the increase in the Safe School Levy for intermediate districts. In my district, we recently had a 16-year-old student who has a severe behavioral disability. He requires a paraprofessional to have eyes on him at all times, and yet recently the student attacked a non-instructional employee, punching him in the face and knocking him unconscious. The attack resulted in a broken jaw for our employee. Police were called and the student was arrested and charged with third-degree felony assault. I'd emphasize that this student has a significant disability and significant mental health needs, and most students with mental health needs are not assaultive, but in the case of intermediate districts, this is often a commonplace type of situation. Because of this student's disability, he will be found incompetent to stand trial, and actually he returned within 10 days to the program where the assault took place. I cite this example because increasingly public schools and increasingly students in intermediate districts come to us with very complex needs, and we are the provider, the primary provider of services to meet the kinds of needs that these kids come through our doors. This student is at significant risk of reoffending. It is a trend for other entities to look toward the public schools to provide or make available mental health services. I would urge that policy members see the tremendous shift that has taken place in responsibility for the public schools to be the entity that, at a minimum, connects mental health services to students. The proposed Safe Schools Levy that you will act on will significantly help provide resources to this kind of critical area. The second component of the bill provides resources for the use of PBIS training. Increasingly, research points to the advantages of using pro-social strategies rather than discipline strategies to successfully keep students in school and on track to receive a high school diploma. A recent study out of Florida suggests that even one suspension at ninth grade greatly increases the chance that a student will drop out of school. In Hennepin County, we have been convening all the superintendents and county commissioners to identify major cross-system barriers that prevent students from graduating from high school. And we know with certainty that discipline policies that use suspension create a push-out effect for students. PBIS, on the other hand, is an evidence-based strategy that is a powerful substitute to the discipline model and one that increasingly has the potential to shift the push-out impact of suspension. Let me share the results of use of PBIS in our Setting 4 program for secondary students who have significant behavioral disorders. The average decrease in the number of behavioral incidents per day from September through March of 2011 for the same time period this year was a decrease of 32%. The decrease in the number of students eloping or walking out of classrooms was reduced by 49%. Verbal abuse was reduced by 42%. Work refusal was reduced by 54%. And classroom disruptions overall were reduced by 13% from last year to this year. These impressive results are with students with the highest behavioral needs in the public school system. And the research suggests that the use of PBIS with all student populations can be a game changer in addressing the achievement gap. I encourage this committee and the legislature to include the use of this strategy through approval of this particular bill. Thank you. The bill addresses PBIS. It's a positive behavioral intervention system, and it really is a whole school approach to creating a positive culture where behavior is addressed in a pro-social way. And everybody in the building is on the same page. It's created through staff involvement, and it really is a very well-documented, evidence-based strategy.
Thank you, Superintendent. We heard at the beginning of the session, this committee, a little bit about PBIS, and I know that in our finance committee we also spent some time exploring, or at least hearing about those models and how they are helping to transform schools into good learning environments. Thank you. Are there other testifiers? Mr. Heller. Well, members, I neglected to acknowledge the students that are about to leave the room. And so just I'm going to freeze them for a second and announce that we have 12th grade students. We have seniors. They're on their way to post-secondary career opportunities, we hope, who are with the Visitation School. And they're here as part of the Capital the Minnesota Historical Society's Capital Historic Sites Voice of the People Day. How's your day been going?
Great.
Yeah? Wonderful. Let's welcome our young people. Almost forgot you, but thank you for being here. Mr. Heller.
Thank you again, Chair Mirani and Policy Board. Members, committee, I mean. Anyhow, regarding the language on in Bill 356 on line 124, I'm trying to understand one of the words. It's, I think it's called co-location. If I understand that correctly, please correct me. Co-location represents that the school district doesn't allow for parent choice. Parents need choice regarding mental health. If you keep not all school special psychologists or shrinks or that parents choose will not come to a school. If you keep the dollars under the roof, the school gets the money. It concerns me that if you infringe upon parents' choice, and if this bill does that, then I would recommend against the bill. Because parents should have choice about who they choose, because typically parents build a team, and since they have choice of who the members are, especially when a child's been attending a psychologist or a psychiatrist or other outside medical professionals that aren't necessarily connected to the education system, it helps represent the more balance of a team. I appreciate that you consider the language change, or at least recommendation for the print disabled who learn in an oral way. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. Members, questions? If not, members, then I will renew my motion. Did we amend? We didn't amend. It is. That House File 356 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Education and Finance. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So we have
it's Newton Day.
Okay. Representative Newton, House File 986. I'm going to move House File 986.
We should get pinned.
This is, oh, okay. So this is an informational hearing, but you have a testifier from
yes,
a little distance, so we want to make sure we have an opportunity to hear from him. And at this point, Representative Newton, we're having just an informational hearing on House File 986.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. My understanding is that the bill was not heard in the Senate.
All right.
And so this is an informational hearing, and we have with us today Dr. Walter Roberts from Minnesota State University of Mankato, who would like to testify on the bill. Very simply stated.
Representative Newton, just so I get this formally, so I will move House File 986 be recommended pass, and we'll be laying that over later, just so it's in front of us formally. So, okay. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What this bill very essentially does is says that if a person who is engaged in counseling and is not a licensed counselor, that they have to notify the students and the parents that they are not a licensed counselor. And I think that's sort of the bill in a nutshell. And I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Roberts.
Dr. Roberts, good morning.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I promise to keep this brief. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on behalf of Representative Newton's bill. 986 is designed, as Representative Newton said, to safeguard students from receiving services from individuals who are unlicensed to perform the duties of a school counselor as defined under Minnesota rule. And likewise, it provides for the accurate reporting of individuals who are serving in an administrative capacity, regardless of what they might be called in a school district. I will be rather blunt and straightforward about the bill. We have a problem in some of our schools when it comes to school districts giving parents the impression that their children are receiving the services of school counselors when, in fact, those services are being provided by individuals without meeting the requirements of licensure as established by the Board of Teaching. This is not about denying services to students, but rather it's about ensuring that the people that provide the services to our children are adequately educated to perform the duties that they're placed in positions to serve. It's also an effort to help school counselors that we have today who are greatly understaffed, as you know, to more effectively serve their students by not placing them in positions which impair their abilities to do their jobs. 986 is also designed to ensure that the data kept on the true cost of administrative personnel hired by school districts is accurate. You have a list of websites that have been handed out along with the letter from the Board of Teaching, which I will address in just a second. These are a list of school districts that were just compiled in just a brief 24-hour period, school districts who indicate that they employ deans or deans of students. Some of these individuals serving as deans may indeed be licensed school counselors. Others, it is less clear what their qualifications are, and many of them really are serving as de facto school administrators. When school counselors are placed in positions wherein they are required to enforce discipline, their roles are in direct conflict with the ability of the counselor to be a neutral problem solver in the future. The reality is, what kid is going to come back to see the individual who is supposed to be the school counselor to talk about a personal issue when that individual also had to just be involved in some type of recommendation to suspend or give some other disciplinary action directed toward the student? The letter from the Board of Teaching that you have is very clear on the subject of the licensure of individuals serving in the capacity of school counselors or administrators. You have to have a license to do so. It makes no difference what a school district chooses to call an individual. It's the practice which requires the license. There is no license for a dean in K-12 schools in the state of Minnesota. And regardless of what one chooses to call a dean in a K-12 school setting, the practice falls under one of two scopes, either as a school counselor or as an administrator. My last point, when a school district implies to parents that services are provided by individuals who require licenses in their professional field, the district and the individuals set themselves up for potential litigation if something goes wrong. Often life and death matters are involved in dealing with student frustrations. We've heard a lot of testimony this session, and we just heard testimony today about the needs of students. School violence, helping students make plans for the future, all of these are a critical element with regard to helping our students deal with the frustrations that they deal with inside our school settings. Not just anybody can deal with these particular issues. 986 is a transparency bill. It is a data accuracy bill. It is a licensure assurance bill. Most importantly, it is another piece of the school safety equation. In this day and age of our concern for all of the issues that are impacting our kids, the least we can do is ensure that the people that are there to serve them are licensed as we have the requirements as posted by our regulatory agencies, such as the Board of Teaching. Thank you for your time, and I'll be available to answer questions.
Thank you. Representative Breitner has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. either Representative Newton or Dr. Walters, and I'll say I'm generally very sympathetic to issues around school counselors and licensure and so forth, but I have a number of questions about whether this is the right solution and the right time, in the sense that, first of all, what it does is provide communication to parents. It doesn't forbid the practice. That's one issue I have. But the other is the dean model is operating in a number of our schools, and we did hear from Irondale earlier this session as a policy committee about the success of the dean model in their school, and they indicated they had a number of professionals licensed in various fields, you know, a drug counselor, a school counselor, an assistant principal, and they worked as a team and they assigned their tasks out as appropriate to their licensure. Now, I'm not saying how that works or doesn't work, but as a legislator, I'm reluctant to support this solution without further investigation of the practice and what's actually going on the ground in schools that are using the dean model. So those are a series of concerns I have about the proposal.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Reinhart and I have discussed this in the past, but I think most schools, you're going to find that the position of dean is sort of an intermediate position between the teacher and the administration, and they tend to be the disciplinarians in the school. They're the ones that mete out the punishments. And all too often, and I know this was the case in Anoka-Hennepin as well, until we eliminated the positions of deans, that the deans were acting as counselors as well, because we had so many students and so few counselors on staff that the deans assumed this additional position. And I can't address how qualified they were in terms of being able to give the right information, but this at least lets the parents know and the students know that they are not licensed counselors.
Very well. Why don't we hear from Mr. Aronson and Mr. Schneiderwin? I think that also get at some of your questions, or at least thank your question.
You want to,
Representative Breiner may generate a few others.
Sure.
Mr. Aronson.
Okay.
Pleased to be here on Jerry Newton Day.
Yeah. Mr. Aronson.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Roger Aronson. I represent the Elementary and the Secondary Principals Association, and Mr. Schneiderwin and I have both been talking about the bill up here, and we looked at it last week as well, and we do understand that this is here for informational purposes. Representative Breinert actually hit it on the head, and one of my members is the principal, Scott Dangler, at Irondale High School. They presented to this committee. They presented in the Senate as well. They were very concerned about this bill when it looked like it was in play, because it would invalidate, I think, a lot of what they do out there. The problem, and I think Senate Representative Breinert laid this out well, but the problem is that we are short-staffed. What a shock. We're short-staffed in assistant principals, we're short-staffed in counselors, and one of the methods that districts have responded with this are the deans that Representative Newton talked about. The second part of this bill refers to STAR reporting, the STAR reporting manual. If you have never looked at it, it's 126 pages long. The department gathers all this data through there. There's some question about whether or not this actually is required under the STAR reporting now, as it's set out here in the bill. I think you'd want to look out here in the bill. I think you'd want to look long and hard before you start statutorily mandating processes through the STAR reporting to get at a problem that we're short-staffed in counselors. The other piece I think that we have is, and I did take a look at the scope of practice of a school counselor under the rule that's set there. This is problematic, as you say, what the scope of practice are, and you put this into the day-to-day operations of a school, and that if someone said to the school counselor, we want you to do X, and that person says, well, I don't think that's in my scope of practice, and I think that might impair my ability to practice within my scope of practice, that's going to open a Pandora's box of problems that you know, you don't want us to do. To engage in. I think, not to keep coming back to her, but Representative Reinert really put it right, that you're going to want to look at what's happening out there in the actual practice. One other thing I want to raise with the committee, and this is informational, but I think it's a good standard for you to think about. So the counselors come down and say, you ought not let us do, let anybody else do our work. We would be very happy to come down here and say, as assistant principals, we don't want you to let anyone else do our work. Don't let those pesky deans take in any of our jobs and any of our responsibilities. We don't do that. And we don't do that because, as a practical matter, how the system works, it doesn't function particularly well when we do that. So keep those in mind as we talk about this, because obviously you're talking about laying it over, and it doesn't mean it's going away. I mean, we're going to talk about it some more, so we wanted to raise those issues, Mr. Chair.
Very well, Mr. Schneiderlin.
Mr. Chair, my name is Kirk Schneiderlin, and I'm on staff with the Minnesota School Boards Association, and believe me, we understand the value and importance of school workers and our school counselors and social workers and all the role that they play within our school district. And I think that's, you know, without repeating what Mr. Aronson said, I think that's one of the things that we are concerned about is the day-to-day practical application of this piece. And so, you know, a piece that concerns us is in paragraph B that talks about the impairment of their abilities. And so what happens then, as if in that scope of practice, if we do assign them to this and then they don't want to, it's not within their scope, and then all of a sudden, is this going to be a grievable issue? Are districts going to have to create policies separate for each teaching group that goes forward? So that's one of the things. And I think another thing is, I mean, think about how frequently we have parent-teacher conferences. And the parents ask the teachers, is my kid ready for Algebra 1? Is my kid prepared for Geometry 2? And the teachers just openly discuss about the planning and what the sequences are. And so I think that's one of the issues, too, that I think that if that were to occur, as simple as examples that would be, that's something that districts now would be required to say, hey, this is not under your purview. This is a duty that's responsible to the counselors and should not happen. And so I think just from a practical point of view, we understand the value, but I think it's something on a day-to-day piece that administrators have to deal with at the local building level. Shouldn't have to deal with. They kind of have a community of school district staff members who work on separate things and do separate items and work together, and I think that's an important piece to consider as well.
Very well. Questions?
Thank you, Chair Mariani. And more of a comment, Representative Newton, I wish you weren't carrying this because I like you so much. But, we keep piling on more and more. And in the back of my mind, I hear the school districts crying uncle. And so at some point, I think with all the things that we've done this year, it seems to me that, in my opinion, we should slide back a little bit, let some of the things that we have in place, or hopefully they don't become in place this year, but give our school districts a little break. So that's... It just seems like one more mandate that we probably don't need.
Dr. Roberts.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I just have one comment. I certainly understand the concerns that have been raised, but I do want to leave the committee with this thought. Either licensure means something with regard to teaching, or it doesn't. And I think we have to look at that, particularly with regard to this particular issue, with regard to what else is happening inside schools where individuals are acting outside their scope of practice. I understand the practicalities, but again, this is about both licensure and scope of practice.
Thank you. We have a question for Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, just trying to explore something here. In Minneapolis, at our seven traditional high schools, we have career and college centers, privately funded, so it's not public funds used. As I understand it, and that's a big caveat here, they use staff who I don't know are licensed counselors or any of the other allied professionals, but who work with students on goal setting around post-secondary goals, helping them get kind of concrete. Okay, you're taking remedial math, but you're telling me you want to go to MIT. Let's work on that. You're going to have to step up your game to get to Boston, and so on. How do those services fit into this bill? Can either the author, Dr. Roberts, help me with that? Because I'm just trying to understand.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dabney, there is nothing in this bill that says that a district could not continue doing what they're doing now. This is about parent notification.
Mr. Chair, let me try to refine the question. Would parents have to be notified that the staff in the Career and College Center are not licensed counselors? Are they infringing on the licensure, the practice area of licensed counselors by working with students on post-secondary choices?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dabney, I would say in that instance, probably not. That is one aspect of the qualifications of school counselors. One aspect. Mm-hmm. It's only if an individual, if the public or parents have the perception that individuals are being served by school counselors with all the responsibilities and the skills that go along with that profession. This is a bill about notifying parents that if that is not the case. It's up to the school district, and again, there is the liability issue, I think, that I think has to be studied.
Thank you.
And Dr. Roberts, I do note that paragraph B in section 1 is a directive about counselors, you know, shall not be placed in positions which impair their abilities to perform their duties. So clearly there's parent notification here, but there's also some directives here that go beyond parent notification. Representative Sawatsky.
Mr. Chair and Representative Newman, I have received a lot of emails asking to say that in support of this bill to notify, have parents be notified, and I just, if you bear with me, I can read it better than say it. It seems to be a growing trend that districts are trying to cut corners costs by having non-licensed people do parts or all of our jobs. Obviously, this is not right, as we have a training masters that we do for a reason. Please vote in favor of this bill and discuss it with your fellow lawmakers. Thank you for being there for us. And then another district, that was my home district, talked about, it seems to be a growing trend. There was a little bit more information on this one. But nevertheless, people, I think, are we cutting corners? I think that it is important that we are accountable because, like you said, we are going to school for a reason and getting our degrees. And then I think parents at least have the deserve that they are who they are getting for their being counseled. For their students.
More a comment than a question. Representative Urusso?
Yes.
Right. Representative Roger Ertz?
Thank you, Chairman. My concern is in my district up there, I'm not receiving any emails from licensed school counselors because there probably aren't any licensed school counselors in any of the small schools that are in my district. Are all parents then supposed to be notified that there are no licensed school counselors in those districts? And then that opens up the can of worms of why isn't that service provided in my small school? Well, the service is provided, but it's just being done by school counselors, nurses, principals, school-to-home intervention officers. There's many hats that people in small districts have. I'm sorry, I'm not very fond of this one.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think we get the final word. Right?
Well, that is very good. I'm glad to hear that. Well, I have just a question about the reference to litigation. Number one, is there a history of litigation concerning this issue? And secondly, does notification to parents invite additional litigation?
Representative.
Mr. Chair and Representative Benson, I personally don't know of any, perhaps Dr. Roberts.
Mr. Chair and Representative Benson, I am aware of one case where an individual that was involved in I have to be careful what I say because I was an expert witness in the case, where an individual who family sued the school district for wrongful death related to advice and counsel that an individual was provided. So there have been cases, not many, but again, I think the potential is there.
Members, we're out of time. We are going to lay this bill over, Representative Newton. And I want to say I do appreciate the tension here. Obviously, our state has, in my opinion, severely underfunded our counseling professional staff. And I think there's all sorts of ideas that are coming forward in terms of how do we deal with the fallout of that, as well as how do we deal creatively with providing services for students. It's appropriate for us to wrestle with those issues. So this one won't go away. We'll continue this discussion certainly throughout the interim. Members, we will meet on Thursday. We have two bills, House File 1059, Representative Morgan, and 336 Winkler. And I don't know if we'll be posting anything prior to that, but stay tuned. We'll meet Thursday morning, and until then, we'll stand adjourned.